Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
JBR Capital has sponsored the Intercooler podcast for several months now. You've probably heard me talk about the company before. In that time, I've come to really understand what it is that makes JBR Capital different to other car finance companies. If I had to boil it down to one thing, I'd say it's this. Car finance is all JBR Capital does. Might sound like a minor detail that, but in fact it's really important. It means JBR Capital has a profound understanding of the car marketplace and of car buyers, an understanding that other finance companies could only hope to have. In fact, that very focused approach is exactly why the company was started in the first place. We recently had Darren Selig, founder of JBR Capital, on the podcast, episode 106, if you want to go back and listen. And he explained that he started the company when he realized that general finance lenders actually didn't understand cars or car buyers particularly well at all. So he spotted that gap in the market and he founded JBR Capital to fill it. So before you buy your next car, be it a supercar, sports car, classic car, a hypercar, or a luxury car, even if it's a brand new car, go and see what JBR Capital can do for you on the finance side. And it really helps us if you tell them that the Intercooler sent you. JBR Capital is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority.
Welcome to the Intercooler podcast.
Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. This is episode 109. Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel with you here as ever. Andrew. Right, this episode actually is about optional extras and how to spec a car, isn't it? Sort of the meat of the podcast. But there's been so much going on.
But also, just the ones we like and the ones we don't, the really bloody pointless ones and the ones, and also our guilty pleasures, because I've got a couple of
those. The things that we have to have. There's loads of them. But we'll come to that later on, because there's been so much going on in the world of cars and racing that I think we just need to acknowledge a few things, don't we, before we get stuck in to the podcast. There's the big news from the last few days is that Tobias Merz is out of Aston Martin. He was there not quite 2 years. Now, I don't know about you, but I kind of assumed that he was going to hang around for a long time. It appeared as though Lawrence Stroll, I guess the de facto owner, had found a CEO in his image, found his man. It sort of looked that way, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, clearly there was. I mean, the situation at Aston Martin when Merz arrived was, I mean, people are very uncharitable about the Andy Palmer era because the company got itself into a lot of debt and so on and so forth. But actually, he had a really good plan, this sort of second century plan. It was actually a really good plan. And the proof of that particular pudding is actually Merz has changed the plan very, very little. The problem was its execution. It was not efficiently executed. And that's what Merz was brought in to do. He was brought in to turn the great theory of the plan into a practical reality. And he was, you know, he was well on the way to doing that. And I suspect that history won't be very kind to MERS either, because, you know, he left because he just pissed off a lot of people. You know, there was, you know, I won't name them all, but there were at least 10 senior executives who walked in his very, very short tenure. I mean, yeah, some of them are famous guys like Dave King, Matt Becker particularly. And, you know, I think he ultimately he just ran out of support in the boardroom and his position became untenable. And so off he went. But, you know, he did a lot of good stuff. He has, you know, put the two sports car lines into one. You know, all the cars now get painted at St. Athens instead of two different. I mean, they have, the number of cars in some stage of build has gone from over 400 to less than 100. The number of workstations required to build a car has gone from 70 down to 23. So this is all really boring stuff, isn't it? But actually, if you look at a car company as something which needs to, you know, not just make really cool sports cars, but actually as a functioning business which needs to make money so it can invest in its future, it's important. It's really, really important. And, you know, and Tobias cheesed off an awful lot of people. But, you know, I think that there is a good argument to say that this was necessary medicine. And you may not like the taste, but, you know, the company wouldn't have survived without it. So, you know, I think I feel a bit inclined to be given the benefit of the doubt, but you can't, you know, you can't captain a ship if the crew are mutinying, and I think that's the situation he found himself in. So he's gone, and Amadeo Felisa is taken over.
Yeah, and it's perhaps even the start of a bit of a trend. So Felisa, he's an older man now, 76, but he was a Ferrari lifer, it appeared, and he's, he was at Ferrari for a long time, and he's bringing with him a new CTO, Roberto Fedeli. Yep. So we've got two guys who help steer Ferrari towards its current current sort of boom state. You know, it's that company now is making tremendous profits. It's reinvesting it back into the most sophisticated cars in the class. Really, that is a company flying, and people like Felisa helped get Ferrari there.
Felisa is a giant. I mean, people, you know, he kind of lived a bit under the shadow of De Montezemolo, and I bow to no one in my admiration for Luca, but Felisa was, he's an amazing engineer. You know, that great Ferrari turnaround they had in the mid-1990s when they stopped making stuff like 348s and Mondials and Testarossas and started making brilliant cars like 550 Maranellos and 456s and F35s. That was, you know, that was all on Felisa's watch as chief engineer. So he is a man of considerable talent. But yeah, you said it, he's 76. And you know, and I know that, you know, Aston Martin isn't a, you know, isn't a sort of part-time job, is it? You've got to be absolutely on it if you're going to do that job. So, you know, I wish him very, you know, all the best. I hope he's got the energy and is up for it. But we'll see, we will see. But, and you know, and you hope, don't you, that actually what Tobias has done, for which he'll probably get press a little thank, is lay the groundwork for a successful resurrection of the business. But time alone will tell that.
Yeah, I mean, MERS did bring efficiencies that ultimately should underpin a stable, more financially secure business. He won't get the credit for turning it into that business if it does happen, but he should get some of it. And, you know, we've heard, I've actually heard mixed things about MERS. Some say that he was very difficult to work for, autocratic. Others have said that actually, if he liked you, he was friendly and approachable. So I'm sure there are lots of different views out there.
I think he's capable of being all those things.
Yeah,
I think he was autocratic. I think he was difficult. I think he was stubborn. I think, you know, he ruffled an awful lot of feathers. I think he did think he knew best, but at the same time, I think his heart was in the right place. I think he genuinely wanted what was best. I think he definitely had a plan. And I think his view was, well, you know, you're either with me or you're not with me. You're either, this is the solution and you're part of it, or you're not. And, you know, some would just call that strong leadership, wouldn't they? You know, he wasn't put in that job to be popular. So, I mean, I don't see the conflict. I don't think that, you know, the people have fundamentally misunderstood him or not. I just think that he was many different things to different people, depending on how what your view of what he was trying to do was. But, you know, there are certainly some incredibly talented people, particularly on the engineering side, who felt unable to get on with the jobs they thought they'd been employed to do. And, well, you get what you get.
It's a good point. And the people, those very talented people who felt like they were, in effect, showing the door, or as though they had no choice but to leave, I'm sure they'll find it quite galling that we might suggest that MERS has left it in a better state than when he found it. But again, it depends on your point of view, doesn't it? There are lots of different opinions on this. So the trend that I was talking about is that Aston Martin have now employed a couple of ex-Ferrari guys in the top two positions. McLaren Automotive has done the same. Michael Leiters is now the new CEO over there, isn't he? So it's really interesting. It's as though if you can't beat them, employ the guys who got them to where they are. It's a classic move, isn't it? And actually, we've seen it in F1 recently as well. We know that lots of other teams have been poaching senior engineers from the likes of Red Bull and Mercedes. It just happens, doesn't it? You know, if you need the experience and the expertise in a certain field, you go to someone who's done it already.
We kind of, and I suspect we'll be doing a bit more of this in a minute when we get onto optional extras. You know, it's quite easy to tease Ferrari and sometimes take the mick out of the sort of people who buy them. But actually, the reason that Ferrari are able to do what they do, which is be far and away the most successful, profitable, you know, pure supercar manufacturer out there, is because ultimately they make bloody good cars, and they have done it. They've been doing it for years. And you and I are lucky enough to get to drive them. And we know that even if most people who buy these cars never drive them in that way, we know how well engineered they are. We know how hard the engineers at Ferrari try to make these cars as good to drive as they can possibly be. And that doesn't mean necessarily the fastest round of track, but the most responsive, the most docile on the limit, the most engaging, the most fun. They make amazing cars. And that is what ultimately underpins their enormous success, because unless you have that brand credibility, even if people are buying your cars not to drive them like that because they just like the idea of being seen in them, why do they like to be seen in them? Because that manufacturer has that brand credibility. So ultimately, it all comes down to the product. And their product is the best, you know, consistently over time amongst that lot. Yes, I mean, I love McLarens and they make some amazing cars and I've driven some, you know, some quite good Lamborghinis and that sort of thing. But ultimately, over the kind of period of time that I'm talking about where you need to establish yourself and just get those fantastic interstellar brand values, Ferrari have been better at it than anybody else. And you get what you get. So it's no surprise at all that the people who are responsible for that are now the people who are most in demand.
Yeah, you go poaching, don't you? Okay, well, we'll see what plays out at both Aston Martin and McLaren. Let's clip along a little bit. BMW M4 CSL. There was a teaser image.
Ooh, yes.
The press release went out in the last couple of days. The return of CSL, and it will be an M4. Now, this is actually only the third time, isn't it, that BMW has used the CSL badge? The first time on the E9, then the E46 much more recently. And yet, that is a powerful, potent model suffix, isn't it? CSL.
It's right. They're writing a big check, aren't they? I mean, it's, you know, it's got to deliver. You know, there's a big promise there, isn't it? You're going to wheel that one out.
Yeah. So we'll see the car later this month.
Yeah. So why not? So the interesting question is why not GTS or, it's going to be different, isn't it?
So we'll see it at the Villa d'Este later this month. The 50th anniversary of BMW M is on the 24th, so perhaps we'll see it on that day. We've had GTS variants of the last M4 and M3. And so there has to be a reason for calling this one a CSL. Are they going to try and find a slightly different character by using this badge? I mean, the last two CSLs have been pretty uncompromising track, you know, weapons. They've had massive grip, pretty solid suspension, big wing on the back, very sticky tires. Do you know, maybe this is fanciful. Well, yeah, I know, and we can have that discussion. I think that this might be fanciful, but wouldn't it be nice if they went just down a slightly different path with the new CSL? A softer touch, not quite so uncompromising, so unyielding, more about lightweighting. I think it would be great, although, you know, they're starting with a almost 1,800 kilogram car, aren't they? So they're not going to turn it into exactly, but 1,300
kilo. That's the thing. No, they're not. But I wonder whether that's what they're indicating here with the use of CSL, L standing for, you know, lightweight, as we know. And maybe that's why they maybe they have decided to do. Wouldn't it be wonderful if they didn't do a track day special, but they just did an optimised M3, M4 road car? They could probably take 150 kilos out of it without too much trouble. And, you know, don't tie it down on its springs. It doesn't need to have huge amounts of horsepower. Just make it a driver's car. A car for people who really get it. And in many ways, you know, that's, you know, kind of car, but on another level that, you know, the M2 Comp and even the M2 CS were. But, you know, just, not like a GTS, which, as you say, is just, it's a track car wearing road car clothing. But just something that is epic on a public road, on the right public road. That'd be fantastic. I'd love it if they did that.
Do you think they will? It seems like a long shot.
I mean, yeah, but I mean, why have they? It's just interesting, isn't it? You know, that's, yeah, it's only, as you say, it's the third time in, what, half a century almost that they've wheeled out that badge. You know, so it's something special that they don't do for no reason at all. And, you know, they don't do these things, you know, lightly. There would have been a lot of discussion over the use of that badge because it is, you know, it's probably their most iconic nameplate. And people have said, well, what makes it different to a GTS? What's going to justify using this? And they'll have to, you know, come up with good reasons for that. I suppose, you know, the marketing people will say, well, it'll just sell, won't it? So let's just hope there's more substance to it than that.
I know, that's the thing. That really is the thing. If they've just wheeled out this name because it's powerful and it's well-timed with the 50th anniversary, that would be a pity. I just hope there's been more thought applied to it, but we'll see. Okay, a couple of other things. Our Defender, we won't hang around on this, but you very recently wrote what was effectively a farewell report to the Land Rover Defender that you've been running on the intercooler. That's on the app now. You had it for 3 months or something, didn't you? And actually, you're not bidding a final farewell quite, because I've got the car now for the remainder of its stay with us, maybe a couple of weeks or a few weeks. But I've had it now for a week, and I've spent a bit of time in it. I have to say, I really, really like it. But I'm just interested in your sort of general thoughts. You wrote about it on the app, but I thought you could maybe just share some of your general thoughts here. You clearly like the thing.
In all regards, other than the engine, which is no longer available in that car. I'm not going to bang on about the engine because, you know, it's not a purchasing decision people are going to have to make unless they're thinking about getting a second hour. Don't get a 2-litre non-hybrid one, petrol. Just don't do it, because somebody told me, and this person works at JLR, so they should know, that the 2-litre petrol uses more fuel than the 3-litre petrol. Because it just has to work that much harder to tow such a heavy car along. So it's not a nice engine. It's not very refined. And the fuel consumption is horrendous. So that's it on the engine. The rest of the car, of course, I should have had a long wheelbase diesel because, you know, it's got the right number of doors and it's easy to get in the back and it's got a boot and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, I'm not the sort of person who really sets a huge amount of store by what cars look like relative to how they are to drive. But I have to say, every time I left home and wandered past it, it just made me happy that it was there. And it's a strange thing, because usually, I've been lucky, I've had all sorts of things parked out here, and I don't usually get that. I usually just walk straight past them and focus on them when I get in to drive them. But it was just a fun thing to have outside the house. And so that was a dimension which I didn't expect. But actually, as far as the driving is concerned, what I was so impressed about was it feels as rugged as you'd want a modern Defender to be. It is absolutely as good off-road as you'd want a modern Defender to be. So it ticks all those boxes. And yet, it's really usable because the ride is good. It's very quiet. The connectivity, the infotainment, for want of a less hideous word, really works properly. So there's no real downside to it anymore, fuel consumption apart. I think that they, you know, I said this when I first drove it, I think, you know, that is the best Land Rover that I have driven since the 2001 Range Rover. I think that they've made, you know, the original Land Rover, the original Range Rover, the 2001 Range Rover, the Evoque, and this are the most impressive products Land Rover has ever produced, and I'd absolutely put the Defender up there with them.
Yeah, I think it's fantastic. So you spent a day at Eastnor Castle, Land Rover's off-road centre, doing some fairly serious off-roading. The photographs from that are remarkable. I'm not going to drive off-road at all. I'm just going to concentrate on what this thing is like to use as a daily and as a road car. This one's got the knobbly Wrangler tyres, isn't it? So it's clearly
It's a mid-spec. That's the mid-spec. That's the on-off-road tyre. So there is a more extreme tyre you can get for it.
Crikey.
But okay. I imagine you get lots of road. I really like that Wrangler tyre because it obviously does the job. I mean, you know, even on that tyre, it was going ridiculous places. You know, so unless you are a professional off-road, you don't need more than that. There are like £200 on the bill of the car. And actually, they give the car a really nice ride quality. And don't forget, you know, this was a very modestly specified car. It's not on air or anything else. So, I'd have them.
Yeah, I would actually. I thought they were going to be noisy on the road. They're just not. Two things have surprised me. It's flipping good on a winding B road. You can really barrel along in it. It steers so well that you just position the car. You're not second guessing. You're not nervous when something big comes your way, breathing in and trying to get the steering angle right. You just drive through the gap. It's lovely. It's actually quite amusing to drive quite quickly along a B road. But also it's good on a motorway. I thought it was going to be noisy. I thought the tyres were going to whine, but they don't. So I'd actually be very happy to do a long journey in that car. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to spending a couple of weeks in it and just learning a bit more about it. And we will write something more about the car on Instagram and on the app as well. Okay, let's just quickly talk about Tony Brooks, who died this week. 90 years old. Was he the last of the great 1950s Grand Prix drivers?
Yes. Yes, without any question at all. Unless I've had total brain fade. I mean, there are a very low single digit number of people who took part in Grand Prix in the 1950s who are still alive. There's one, I think, who's past 100 years old. But let's put it this way. The oldest person alive today to have won a Grand Prix is now Jackie Stewart, and he won his first in 1965, 10 years after Tony Brooks won his first Formula One race. So it really is, you know, now that he has gone and now that Stirling has gone and now that guys like Surtees and Dan Gurney have all departed, it's kind of passed into history, that era. And the astonishing thing to me, as someone who was lucky enough to get to know most of these characters, is looking at them as part of that history when they have, for so much of my career, been part of my life. And Tony was the last of them, really. And, you know, I didn't know him as well as I knew Stirling, but we exchanged Christmas cards every year. I often went to his place in Ossershaw, sat down. He was fantastically generous with his time. He was always happy to be interviewed. And he was just this lovely, kind, thoughtful, gentle man. It was almost like, you know, he was just like a lovely bloke you might meet in the street, who for some reason also had this God-given talent. And I wrote this in the little obituary I wrote on the Instagram site. You look at where he won. He won at Monza. He won at the Nürburgring. He won at the Old Spa. He won at Reims. He won at the Arvus. I mean, these are the most terrifying tracks. You know, the quickest circuits. Of a kind, even the Nürburgring has changed so much since those days. And if you think of what Monza was like or what Spa was like, I mean, the Arvus was just absurd. So, you know, he had an ability to drive fast cars on fast circuits and the courage. You know, he was just an extraordinary driver. I know Stirling held him in the highest possible regard. Certainly after Stirling, the greatest British driver never to win a world championship. You know, he came within 4 points of it in 1959, I think. You know, in 1958, Mike Hawthorne won one Grand Prix and won the title. Tony Brooks won three and didn't. I think he's a very, very underrated man. And, you know, I'm sad because the person I knew, liked and respected is gone. But I'm also sad because with him goes an entire era. There's no one I can now ring up and go, you know, what was Deportago like? What was, you know, cast a lot of you like. I don't know anyone to ask these questions to anymore because they've all gone. And you know, I miss the man and I miss his knowledge. And yeah, it is. And actually, because he was always around, when Sterling went, it wasn't the end of the era because we still had Tony. But now I fear it is.
Yeah, we just hope we've downloaded enough over the years from guys like Moss and Brooks to so that the spirit of that age stays alive and we can all appreciate what it was that they did. So Brooks won 6 Grand Prix, second in the championship, as you say, in 1959. Actually, 6 Grand Prix wins for a 50s driver is a good number, isn't it? They didn't compete in that many races. They didn't have long careers. So
no.
6 is a big haul. And as you say, at the most fearsome circuit. So yeah, rest in peace, Tony Brooks. Option extras then.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about the little things, the little silly things that we can't help but tick on a box or wish a car has. And we'll also get stuck into some of the more significant things as well. But just to sort of get us underway, I just want to talk about the little silly things that we'd like a car to have. Heated seats. I want my cars to have heated seats. Mine doesn't, but I wish it did. Mine doesn't have folding mirrors. It'd be good.
Your defender does.
Your defender does, yeah. Mine for maybe a couple of weeks. Do you know what? A silly one that I was insistent when I bought a Mini Cooper S R56 several years ago, many years ago, and I was determined that it would have the optional centre armrest, and I rejected a handful of good cars because they didn't have the armrest, and I found one eventually that did, and it made. I don't know what it is, but I like cars with centre armrest. I just find them more comfortable.
I love centre armrest.
Sit more square, and yeah, I was very pleased that I took the time to find one that had that. What else? Parking camera, sensors. What do you need in a car these days?
Okay, so heated steering wheels. Okay.
Yeah.
They're quite a recent thing, and before they came along, if someone said to me, "Would you want a heated steering wheel?" I would have gone, "Well, probably not." Now, I actually, every time something turns up, it's one of the first things I look for. I mean, there's not so much this time of year, but in the winter, I love a heated steering wheel now, and I'm knocking about in an S-Class at the moment, as you do. Of which more on another podcast, but that's got a heated seat, it's got a heated steering wheel, and it's got heated armrests too.
Yeah.
So both your arms, you get warm elbows too. And, you know, I'm just a sort of middle-aged sybarite, aren't I? And I just love, you know, wallowing around in all this luxury. Heated seats are, totally non-negotiable for me. I have to have heated seats. I love a heated steering wheel.
Yeah.
Occasionally, when things like Porsches turn up, and you know where the heated steering wheel button is on something like a 911, it's hidden behind the bottom spoke of the steering wheel. Mm. So you've got to put your finger through the spoke and press the button that's behind it. And literally, I get in these cars, and the first thing I'm doing is I'm going down there, and I'm like, oh, God, it hasn't got a heat. It's pathetic, really.
Send it back.
I love it. I do. I absolutely love it. Oh, I know what I'm going to ask you.
Go on.
What do you think of sunroofs?
I don't like the principle behind sunroofs, putting extra weight, and a lot of weight, actually. If you could pick one up on its own, you'd realise. And it's literally in the worst place, isn't it? Right at the top in the roof. I don't ever choose to open them.
Ever?
No, never.
No,
actually.
Not me. No.
What are they for?
No.
There'll be people who love them.
I mean, and also you don't get... I don't mind so much a sliding steel sunroof because when it's shut, it feels properly shut. But what you get now is you get these huge panoramic glass roofs, which are kind of smoked, and they've got a cover you can pull forward. But you still get the light still percolates through. And you know, I love feeling cocooned in a car. I like feeling in a car and dark in a car, and it's all part of it. And yeah, I just don't get it. There was a time before air conditioning, when you had to have one. And they're fair enough. Fair enough. When I was buying my 205 GTI years ago, I spent so much time looking for one without a sunroof. And you can find them, but they're really, really rare and very sought after. I gave up in the end and got one with a sunroof. And that's understandable because, you know, you couldn't get air conditioning for that kind of car. And it was hot, you know, then they had a purpose. But these days, I just don't understand it.
No.
Hate the things.
No, you're right. Air conditioning has made them redundant. If it's hot, you don't want a sunroof open. You want the aircon on. Do you know, this doesn't really relate to optional extras, so I'll be quick. But when I was out in LA a couple of years ago, I realized that when they go canyon driving and on the roads, you know, the Angeles Crest Highway and others around there, a lot of them, just as a matter of habit, I suppose, they have the windows down. And even if they're going for a spirited drive, they'll have the windows down. And it's just the thing that you do out there. And I was kind of confused by this. When I try and drive now with the windows down, I find that extra noise, and it's a lot of noise when you're clipping along, distracting. And the wind, you know, that's coming into the cabin, I find that distracting as well. And it might be that we're just not used to doing it here in the UK, because the opportunity, certainly, you know, for half the year, you don't want the windows down, you're going to get soaked. So maybe it's just a matter of getting used to it.
And you can bet they're driving along with the windows down, but still with the air conditioning on.
Yeah, I'm sure. It was really odd. So
they're trying to air condition the planet.
Yeah. I just thought, I can't drive as well. I can't focus as much with the windows down. Odd thing. Okay. Do you know, the thing about optional extras, and I don't know if there are any other little ones that you want to discuss before I move it on.
I want to give you a sort of a big picture view.
Okay.
Of optional extras, which is that, why do they exist? They exist for one reason and one reason only, which is to make their manufacturers money. I'm not sure how many people appreciate that actually a bare car, the margins on those for manufacturers aren't great. So they make their money, particularly premium cars, they make the money on the optional extras. And the lengths they go to persuade you to tick this box, tick that box. So they're always dangling these little goodies in front of you. And when you're sitting there on the configurator and you've already spent, you know, 60 grand on something, another, you know, 800 quid on this, that, or the other, doesn't sound very much by comparison. Whereas if you're just looking at that 800 quid in isolation, you think, wow, that's an awful lot of money. And, you know, we hear stories, and I'm not going to name names because these are only anecdotes, but I do kind of believe that there are manufacturers of super premium cars out there who essentially won't sell you a car without a certain degree of option content on it. The car will just be unavailable. And you know, you even hear stories about them saying, yeah, well, you know, you need to spend this much money on options and we'd like these options on the car because they know that's going to preserve its residuals or whatever. And ultimately, I absolutely believe that 90% of the money that gets spent on options is wasted. A, because you never get it back when you come to sell the car, and B, because you have been hoodwinked into buying stuff you don't actually need, or indeed will particularly want. Things like, you know, do you think that Defender would really ride massively better on air springs than it does? Is the ride in any way deficient? And yet you can get air springs on a Defender. Active anti-roll bars, Porsche have those. I mean, they work kind of okay. No, they do work well if you're on, you know, if you're on a track day. But you know, for most of the rest of the time, you know, that's a four-figure sum that you're spending on stuff you don't need. You know, carbon ceramic brakes. You know, again, on a track, fantastic. But for most people, most of the time, you know, it's quite cool, I guess, to tell people that you got carbon ceramic brakes. And then you've got the ridiculous stuff. You know, and this is where we can invoke Marinello, the sort of carbon fiber lined boot. For thousands of thousands of pounds spent putting a stripe on your car. And I don't know. It is so rare that a car comes to me for any reason at all, and I think, oh God, this hasn't got, because I mean, what do I want a car to have? I want it to have bum warmers. I want it to have nav. I want it to have a digital radio. I want it to have cruise control. Well, you know, almost all cars have almost all those things these days anyway, as standard. So that makes me happy. I don't, you know, I want nav that works properly because that annoys the hell out of me if it doesn't. But I don't actually think I really want anything else in a car. I don't need anything else, and I certainly wouldn't spend my money on anything else. You know, huge wheels. Well, why? I guess you think it makes you look cool, but you know, you're wrecking your ride quality. You know, they're expensive. They're easily damaged. I know that our designer friends will be not best pleased with this, but generally speaking, I absolutely believe that less is more, and that we are being constantly cajoled by car manufacturers to spend more money on this stuff. Money that you'll never ever see again when you sell the car. So just think carefully about it.
Yeah, and one of the, you know, on a, I don't know, an 80, 90, 100 grand sports car, for instance, it's so easy to add another 20%, 30% on top of that on extras.
Yeah.
By the time you've specced a car up, honestly, forget the list price. You're nowhere near it.
No.
And it's an enormous amount of money. And then you just have to start thinking, well, hang on, if I just instead went for the model up, would I be getting a better driving experience for the same cash? You know, could I have a GT3 rather than a Carrera? Okay, you have to be chosen to buy a GT3, but you take my point. Or should you have a turbo rather than a four-wheel drive Carrera, for instance? It's a significant sum of money that you can drop on optional extras that may well not improve the ownership or the driving experience.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But as you say, this is how manufacturers make their money. And they're going to keep doing it. They're going to keep pushing it and doing more and more. And it's not just manufacturers, the OEMs, you know, it's all of them. It's the resto mod sector. Anyone who's selling you a car, they will make their money on the bits on top, the additional extras, because that's where the margin is. So I guess it's just part of the game now, isn't it, really?
Yeah. Yeah. So don't play it. Don't play it. Just be really careful and considered about it, and ask yourself if you really need titanium dust caps on your Ferrari. Are you going to notice? Is anybody going to notice? The only way anybody will actually notice is if you take one off and go, look, I've got a titanium dust cap on my Ferrari, to which they'll probably respond, why?
Why? Well, so
and
what?
And then you can explain about the 2.5 grams of unsprung mass you've managed to save. I don't know. It's what is the greatest? Well, I'll tell you what mine is. The greatest cost of optional extras on a car that's ever come to you. Bentley once dropped a Bentayga here that had £75,000 worth of options on it.
I was going to say around 50 or something, but that is an astonishing amount of money. Imagine the car you could buy for 75 grand, the entire car.
That's yes.
Bananas. The one thing I wanted to add to this conversation about optional extras was I actually wanted to run through the Porsche configurator just to give an impression of how complex it has become. So indulge me for a moment, okay? The business has gone well.
What are we buying?
We're buying. I've decided I want a 911, and I've decided I want a Carrera GTS.
Okay.
And I've already had to decide if I want a coupe, a Targa, or a cab. I want a coupe.
Yep.
I've already had to decide if I want a manual gearbox or a PDK, and I want a manual. And I've already had to decide if I want four-wheel drive or rear-wheel drive. So even before I've come to the configurator, I've had many, many decisions to make.
But in each case, you've chosen the cheapest decision.
True. Very true. Yeah, so... God, actually,
that is a good
point.
That is not a coincidence.
It's not, is it? Okay, so on the configurator, you start with colour, which is fair enough, and there are quite a few colours. You can, of course, have paint to sample if you want, and if you can get a slot, which is more than £6,000, where you basically choose any colour you like. But even on the standard colours... They're all 800 quid to £1,000. Sorry, there are a few standard colours. There are four standard colours you can choose from, but then there are metallics and special colours. The metallics are 876 and the specials are £1,919. So that's fair enough. You then have to choose your wheels. There are three different options there. And then you move into the seats. And there are three different types of seat there. You can have a comfort seat, you can have a fixed bucket seat, and there's a sort of sport seat in between. And then you've got the interior colours, and there are loads of different colourways to choose from. I find those quite confusing, and they're not cheap. £4,000 you can spend on interior upholstery. Then we have individual options. Oh, of course, you can then choose stitching and seat centres. You can spend more than almost £3,000 on stitching. My goodness me. And contrasting leather. Then we come to equipment packages. The lightweight package, do you remember that on the GTS?
I do, absolutely, yeah.
Almost £6,000. And it brings you things like, what does it get you? I'm trying to load it now.
It takes away the rear seats.
Yeah. and other lightweighting things. £6,000, though, that is an enormous amount of money. And then we've got the electric tilt slide sunroof, which we've already discussed. You can have a glass one if you like for £1,600. Lightweight carbon fiber roof for $2,500.
No thanks.
Then it just keeps going. Sport design side skirts, £750.
No.
This is bananas. And then you can choose if you want your Porsche logo LED door courtesy lights. And then you choose badge delete, or if you want your badges in black.
Oh, badge delete. I'd have badge delete. Well, maybe not on GTS. On GT3, I'd have a badge delete.
Yeah, that'd be cool. That would be cool.
Yeah. But presumably that's a no-cost option. You have to pay to have your badge removed.
I don't think so. But you can have it in black or in a different finish or whatever, and you do have to pay for that.
Yeah.
And then we've got, as a no-cost option, standard Porsche Active suspension management instead of the minus 10 mil drop sport suspension. I suspect I'd have that because I don't really want...
I'd have that, yeah. But that's not an option, is it? That's kind of like standard. It's almost a sort of...
Well, it comes with
reverse
the...
Reverse option.
Yeah, it comes with the minus 10 mil ride height sport as standard.
Yeah.
But you can, for no cost, have the... yeah, it's confusing. Have the...
But I mean, that's like having a car with an automatic gearbox as standard and then saying all the manuals are no cost option. Whereas in the past, it would always be in the manual slot and then you paid extra for the auto. So in fact, all they're doing is charging you the same for the manual, which is cheaper for them than they would for the auto. The manual should cost less, as should the standard suspension. So they're appearing to be really generous, or we're not charging you for this, but in fact, they're already charging you for the one you don't want.
Yeah, thank you. Then you can have a front axle lift, which is handy.
I'd have that.
Yeah, and I can't go into all of it because it's just phenomenally detailed and complex. But the point I really wanted to make, apart from that, is there are things that fundamentally change how the car drives, particularly rear-wheel steering, which is not cheap.
Yeah.
Would you have it?
Depending on... For the road on a 911, no. I love it on big barges.
Yeah,
because of that wheelbase shortening effect and the effect it has on the turning circle, that sort of thing. If I was using it, as a sort of road and track thing, then I might think about it. I mean, I have driven. In fact, I had a long-term 911 with rear wheel steer, and it was good. But I wouldn't say it was transformative, and I certainly wouldn't have the active anti-roll bars on it because I had that on the same car and I never used them. They ruin the ride on the road and on the track. The car is more than good enough without them.
Yeah. So if you left me alone for 10 minutes, I could, I'm sure, spec a basic GTS up to 150 without really trying terribly hard, which is, and it's not just Porsche who does this, of course, but it's illustrative, isn't it?
Can I make a point here? Yeah, it is. And that term basic GTS is actually a contradiction in terms, because your starting point with this, a GTS is meant to be the well-equipped one, isn't it?
Yeah.
The GTS is the one, is like the S with a bit more power, but all the goodies you'd have to usually option into an S. So your baseline start point is already should be a very well-equipped car. And yet you can still, as you say, splurge another 50, probably half as much again as you've already spent on the car, just putting stuff on it.
Oh.
Do you remember that white 992 Carrera that they had? Which was basically poverty spec 911.
Yeah.
They might still have it. I can remember that coming here, and I went tooling about that. I can't remember for a moment thinking, oh, bloody hell, this hasn't got that. It was lovely.
Mm.
It was also standard rims. It had a sports exhaust, but that was it. It had standard suspension. It had steel brakes. It was on standard wheels and tyres, and it was just lovely.
Yeah, there was a green one.
Aventura
green, isn't it? There was a green one before that white one. Again, similarly simple. It's just a Carrera, so you can't have a manual gearbox in the Carrera. You need the S for that. But that aside, I think it's the sweetest 992 I've driven. It was absolutely gorgeous. There you go. I mean, it is this whole, the world of optional extras, it's bananas, isn't it? But there's a good reason for it.
It is.
They make money from it, and they're going to keep doing it.
But that doesn't mean you have to play that game.
No, you really don't have to if you don't want to. Okay, well, all that's left for this episode now is the listener question. And I hope you've given this a little bit of thought, because it's got me stumped, I have to say, but I know you'll have something.
Have you told me what it is yet?
I did send it to you, but I think you'll come up with something off the top of your head anyway. It'd be a good test. Before we come to that, thank you, JBR Capital, for sponsoring the podcast as ever. It's great having you guys on board. So if you're looking to finance your next car, just go and talk to JBR Capital and see what they can do for you. Please rate and review the podcast. Wherever you listen to your podcast or watch the podcast, please subscribe or follow. That really makes a huge difference. So please do that if you haven't done so already. The listener question then comes from Chris B. Allen. What is your favourite against all odds racing story? It doesn't even need to be a success. But I guess Chris is after some kind of David and Goliath or, you know, achieving something remarkable against vanishing odds. It can be any strand of motorsport you like. Should we give you a moment?
Okay. This won't be a very satisfactory answer because it's just me banging on about old Bentleys again, but it's the first one popped into my mind. So 1927, Le Mans, 3-litre Bentley gets involved in an enormous accident which takes out the whole of the rest of the Bentley team. The car is presumed to be written off. It only has one headlight. It has a completely bent chassis and the brakes aren't working properly. And they put it back out into the race just to see if the thing will even function. And it won the race by a greater margin than any car in the history of that race up until this day. No car has ever won by a greater margin.
I think that was presumably written off. I think that's a fantastic answer. Brilliant. Well, there
Sammy Davis, sports editor of Autocar, and eminent bacteriologist Dr. Dudley Benjafield, who also hated driving at night, and he did hour after hour at night in a 1927 Bentley, which even with both headlights working basically has no lights, and he did it with one headlight. And they had a torch strapped to the running board as well. That's how bad it was. Off the top of my head, I'm sure I could think of another one, but off the top of my head. And I did see that you sent that through, but I just didn't give it any thought until now. But yeah, there you go.
Okay. Well, there you go, Chris. I thought that was quite a good answer. So get your listener questions in, please, because it's a fun way to end the podcast. And we'll be back next week.
Look forward to it. All the best.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.